I like the idea of an exhibition or a program that is like a chord on a piano. The bass note is the gallery experience. It's the sensual encounter with objects. But then you can have these higher notes that are happening in the virtual space, and you can commission artworks that exist only online.
Says Nadim Saman, writer and curator, who I met for a new edition of our podcast, Was macht die Kunst? What is art up to? Right after the opening of his new exhibition, Poetics of Encryption, at KW, Institute for Contemporary Art in Berlin. What are the arts up to right now, dear Nadim?
Well, I think, as we all know, we're living through a profound period of accelerated technological change. And specifically, in this moment, we hear a lot about AI and how it's redrawing all the possibilities of creation, generative topics of all kinds, from video to text and so on. And I think artists want to find a way to talk about this time, talk about our personal experiences.
Before curating the exhibition, you wrote a book with the same title, Poetics of Encryption. It was published by Hatje Kanz last year. You also organized a conference with artists and scientists. Which questions have been at the beginning of your research, and what answers did you find?
I think while we all rely on new technologies for so many aspects of our life, you know, we rely on our phones to get around, you know, think about how your love life is changed by certain apps or getting around cities by others. Even the economy is being changed by automatic trading and so on. We rely on all these things to be contemporary people, and yet we rarely understand how these systems work. I think the question is, how do artists talk about this tension that we feel? The fact that we rely on so much technology, that it's in all aspects of our world, and yet we can't always peek under the hood, figure out, you know, how it exactly operates, or even understand all of what it is doing in any particular time. How do artists talk about that? What are the pictures that they offer that express this relationship? What are the narratives that they develop that talk about this tension between understanding and ignorance?
And was there some answer that you found from a particular artist or scientist that changed your perception?
No, what I found is that while there are so many new technical opportunities available, I think we all operate also on a human level of human sensorium, our eyes, our ears, touch. And when we talk to one another as people, we tell stories, we express our emotions, we have to share a common currency. And so there's a work of translation that goes on. And that work of translation is something that art has been doing since the beginning of time, which is attempting to talk about, you know, in a way, the ineffable, the mysterious, you know, the things beyond ourselves. And while the internet or while AI will never be a god in itself, certainly some of the techniques that we've been using in the frame of art for a long time track on. So, you know, the myth of technology is just as important in the politics of our life as the reality.
While the Anthropocene has been a dominant critical term in the last decade of curating, you're proposing a new era, the technocene. When did this era start in your perception, and what do you try to describe with this term?
So there's a couple of valences to the term technocene. And on the one hand, it does relate to the topic of the Anthropocene. However, Anthropocene discourse speaks about how, you know, there really is no part of the world, no part of our, you know, lived environment that is untouched by the human hand, by the, you know, say, pollution, by material intervention. We are in some way inescapable. It has an environmental thrust. What I tried to do with this project, with this book, is bring that discourse together with these previous conversations about simulation and simulacrum and the virtual. In fact, you cannot have a virtual fantasy without a hole in the ground, without an open pit mine, without environmental extraction. And this is something, of course, Kate Crawford talks about in her book, Atlas of AI, and others before her. But the two come together in this exhibition. You know, the fantasy of technology, the way it distorts our mind, the social conversation, and the environmental reality. So that's one sense of the term technocene. It relates back to Anthropocene. The second sense is that at this moment where almost everything can be datafied, you can scan, you know, a body, you can look into it, you can decode the code of DNA. When everything can be datafied, then all this data sort of exists on a single plane and it can all be reshuffled. Under these circumstances, the question of what is past, what is present, what is future, what is you, what is me, what is a human, what is an animal, what is a living being, what is a machine, they're all scrambled. We can create cyborgs, we can create hybrids between human and animals on the microscopic scale. Of course, it's illegal, but it's possible. And so all these things are just in an absolute flux of hybridity. And I think the techno scene is this moment wherein all these categories, especially temporal categories, break down. You know, even when you pass on, when you die, your data trail is left behind. It could be used to train an AI avatar of yourself. And one of the works in our show by Emmanuel van der Auwera speculates on this. You know, it has people talking to their dead relatives in avatar form. So in the techno scene, the past is absolutely alive in the present in a really extreme way. And then everything is just reshuffled and constantly recombinable to a new future past.
In your book, you shed a light on every one of us and speak of a certain powerlessness when it comes to our daily technical devices and the digital platform we interact with. We somehow depend on them and we cannot really help but offering these devices a lot of our personal data and our lives. So the big tech companies have all this data and we feel powerless. How powerless are we?
It's pretty difficult. It really is. As I said, I think there is this narrative that has been offered for a long time from Silicon Valley that the world is getting more transparent, things are opening up, we're getting knowledge at our fingertips, you know, all these tools are coming online to extend our ability to kind of just to have more control over the world around us, cognitively, intellectually, and so on. But I think there's a flip side to this, and that is with the profusion of these technologies, also a profusion of black boxes, a profusion of ignorance. Everywhere we turn, we encounter systems and devices and so on that we really don't have a, you know, equal relationship with. We don't really know how they work. Or even if we could, the companies keep it proprietary. You need a key. You need like the keys to the system to really understand it. And so there is this tension there between sort of promise of enlightenment or the ideology that there is enlightenment and I would say a creeping darkness. And it sounds dramatic, but I think it actually is. And so, yeah, how do we deal with that? Well, it's on the one hand, you can try to know more and you must. And artists try to use the newest techniques. They do investigate. They try to map political and social economic situations in their work. But where that is not possible, there is another track, and that's the track of course, metaphor and the translation into image and narrative, which is indeed the ancient province of art. And it may not solve the problem, but it allows us to talk about it, you know, with one another. We need to find new images that can be our common currency because we cannot speak in binary code.
The title refers to the encryption of our digital interactions, the encryption of our geodata, the encryption of our mails and messages. What else does the term encryption refer to?
So I've been speaking about metaphors and about translation, and what I wanted to do was open up this term. You know, if even a year ago, 6 months ago, people were still talking about crypto and NFTs and things like that. You know, for a time, there were people who really wanted us to believe that cartoon monkeys were the future of art. And I just thought that was, I really wasn't a fan of that. And I wanted to, and I understood that within the term encryption and crypto, I mean, there's something dark in it as well. It's not all shiny. It's not all colorful. There's a crypt in encryption. And that crypt is also a spatial metaphor, that naturally involves a body. Bodies are what are buried in the crypt. And so the question is, where is the embodied, intelligent human in relation to the sort of encrypted technologies? What in one's imagination? So in the first instance, the first chapter of the book, Black Site, it's about being locked in. You are the thing that's buried in that crypt. You know, are you buried alive? Can you find your way out? Or what is the space that you're in? Maybe it's dark in there. How do you map this space? So locked in. And then the flip side, you're locked out. Maybe someone or something that you value is buried in there and you would like to break in and recover it, maybe rescue this particular, valued persona. But there's a difficulty, this is the sort of expectation. There is a spatial imaginary in the concept encryption, which gives us back the body for us to talk about, And we need to keep the human in the picture. Like I said, you know, I mean, within all this change, the question for me is always, where is the human? You know, where are the things that we want to carry over from the old world, from the time before all of this? You know, that's not such a conservative enterprise. I'm talking about things like love, a humane concept. I'm talking about things like justice. I mean, look, the figure of justice on the court of law is literally, you know, there's the figure of justice. I mean, this sort of the way we imagine these values, they're put in human form. How much of those can carry through into this encrypted future?
I was thinking about it before we met, that encryption in German is Verschlüsselung. So it has a different concept. One is the key. Schlüssel means key. And you have the crypt, which is, of course, the space. And one is very dark and one is very, feels more like active and enabling. And the other one feels really more as this locked in image that we have of it. So it's interesting how these two languages have a different approach. And of course, in English, it sounds much more mysterious too.
Well, the practice of locking is, you know, goes both ways, because can we have control of our own borders? You know, can we encrypt ourselves to the machine, as it were, such that it doesn't look right the way through us and like peer into the deepest part of us and turn us around and upside down? We would like to remain a little bit opaque to these systems that surveil and extract from us these things. So yes, I think the active and, you know, empowering idea of locking is also fine. And we need to be able to do that ourselves. It can't be that we are open to everything. We are to be inspected. We are to be pushed around and turned inside out. But the things that do that are unavailable to us. We need to be locked as well. We need to have our own boundaries.
Part of this very poetic title, poetry, the poetics of encryption, how much poetry is in it? Your title hints at the poetics of the techno scene. So poetics sounds like something beautiful.
Yeah, you know, I was inspired by the French philosopher Gaston Bachelard, who was first a philosopher of science. And then after that, he wrote a series of books about aesthetics, such as the poetics of space, the poetics of reverie, and the psychoanalysis of fire, things like that. But what I found really, I mean, just really opened my mind was that sort of said, you know, the images that poets use, I mean, he's talking about poetry. I talk about art. You know, they don't like arrive in, you know, from the blue, like they're not put into the poet's head like by God or something like that. He says that these images, real poetry is the result of engagement with materials, with materiality. He says even forms of speech, you know, he says there's a primal poetry of water. The way that water rolls over stones, it gives you sounds like the babbling brook, the babble, you know, things like this. So engagements with certain materials and the way they feel, the way they are in our lives, they generate images, you know? So I think that as we pass through our daily life surrounded by all this technology and all these new systems, there's almost like natural kind of imaginative pathways that result. And I think one of these is the spatial metaphor of the crypt. I really do.
What are the digital tools of contemporary artists that have surprised you the most when you research their projects and when you just opened this exhibition?
Well, I don't know about surprise. I mean, I don't think any of us are surprised that artists are using generative AI techniques in their work, and increasingly so. I mean, even 3 days ago, OpenAI launched Sora, which is a text-to-video generation. You can certainly expect artists to be using that in a hot minute. So that's not surprising. But the way in which I would like to surprise, and which I think some artists would like to surprise too, is that we don't always have to be chasing after the tech companies. We don't always have to be downstream, like some company in Palo Alto releases some gadget, and then we should be waiting to be the first to immediately jump on it and make some art with it. That is exactly where they want us to be. But there's another way. You can use even, you know, like I said, analog techniques to talk about technology. Think about this map, this gigantic map diagram that we have in the center of Cavay. It's a 24-meter long map. It's 3 meters tall. And it describes the relationship between power and technology for 500 years. It's by Kate Crawford, who's a world-leading expert on AI, and Vlad Anyola. And it's really just lines and boxes and text, and yet it's this organigram that teaches you so much. It feels like a blueprint for understanding. So what's surprising is that there is a lot you can do even if you don't have the newest tool in your pocket. There are still ways to express reality. And so I think that what this show offers is a broad spectrum approach to how can we talk about technology, how can we think about technology in the frame of art. And it turns out you don't only have to use the newest generative AI model to speak about the times we live in. Of course you can.
So this is an analog project you just described. Can you also highlight some of the artist projects that use digital media that we encounter at the exhibition right now?
Yes, of course. So there's a wonderful new commission by an American artist based in London called Andrea Cora. It's a commission by Carvey and a Kunsthaus Charlottenburg and also Blest Foundation in London. And it is a film in which actors play these roles. There's two actors. One actor plays a kind of podcaster, so it's very appropriate for our conversation today. And she is interviewing the CEO of a psychedelic pharmaceutical startup from somewhere in California, obviously. Psychedelic pharmaceuticals are a new industry, of course, in Silicon Valley, you know, like some analogs of LSD and things like that, or analogs of ketamine, or even like crosses between the two. And these are drugs that are being developed almost as supplements. You know, you might take them to aid in your productivity and also spirituality at the same time. So it's kind of the collapse of the hippie dream into a kind of really slick capitalist situation. But so this podcaster is interviewing the CEO about his vision for the company and what it is. And he offers her the product at the beginning of the podcast. And while they are having the podcast, she is coming up into the hallucination. And so the visuals are done with, you know, kind of a suite of recent generative AI sort of products. And so, you know, like her hands start to melt into kind of knots of fingers and his face starts to kind of like warp. And then, of course, it snaps back into reality in the kind of conversation we're having now. It has this beautiful animation, you want to call it. And it's the kind of production that you couldn't dream of having even 5 years ago without like much, much huger budget. I mean, you can have a very lean production and you can have outputs that would have been Hollywood standard, you know, a decade, 2 decades ago, for sure. And that's one production. And you sit in these sort of medical chairs, cosmetic chairs, and you can kind of, it washes over you. And it's very strange indeed. This cross between spirituality and a kind of capitalist, you know, I wouldn't say nightmare, kind of like this sort of banal evil of this sort of coffee shop spirituality. So there's that. I mean, there are other videos too. There's a piece by French artists Emily Brout and Maxime Marion, and it's a video, again, using generative imagery of these like faces. They're floating heads and they're singing almost like an opera somehow over some very strange kind of poppy soundtrack. But it dramatizes the coming into consciousness and then super consciousness of an AI. But this AI is narrating its own journey through the explosion in its cognitive capacities and its desires and how much it wants. And of course, it's very narcissistic. It's all about it and what it wants and how it feels. And it's sort of arguing with other versions of itself. So that's a really strange video with a really wonderful soundtrack. Those would be two I could pull out straight away.
Wonderful. I look forward to seeing it. The exhibition is also happening online with some works that are only accessible through the website. It's poeticsofencryption.kw-berlin.de. You should definitely check it out. How much of your curatorial practice do you expect to happen online in the next years? How should museums position themselves in the techno scene?
I am of the view that we need to make exhibitions that straddle both online and offline space in a kind of more seamless way, at least at the level in which we communicate them. So in as much as land art has told us that, you know, art can happen outdoors and your sculpture exists in the expanded field and site specificity is all very clear, we should also understand that exhibitions don't end at the museum's walls. The museum's galleries don't end with the walls too. They can be offline, online galleries. You know, there has to be a kind of equal weight given to the two spaces. Of course, I would never leave behind the physical encounter with art. It's, you know, it's my main passion. But I like the idea of an exhibition or a program that is like a chord on a piano. The bass note is the gallery experience. It's the sensual encounter with objects. But then you can have these higher notes that are happening in the virtual space, and you can commission artworks that exist only online. But then I think the way in which you get to the artworks also needs to be curated. It's not like the website is always like a signpost that points from you to one thing or another. You can complicate it. You know, maybe the cursor is an artwork. Maybe the way the website is navigated has to be, you know, reimagined each time. So I think we should think of each project as existing in multiple dimensions of reality, from physical reality to virtual reality, always at the same time.
If time travel was real, what place and period would you visit?
I think I'd like to go back to Venice of the, you know, 1600s, 1700s, the most decadent part of it. I'd really like to go to the old carnival of Venice while it was still the Venetian Republic.
What's your most important tool?
Conversation with artists, my big mouth. Yeah, just talking. I really love talking to artists. I like talking without a time limit. I like talking even in, you know, on the dance floor in nightclubs all night. I'd rather talk than dance even sometimes. That's how I find things out. That's how I negotiate shared creative reality, where we can push, you know. Yeah, like if I float a lot of balloons, you know, and some of them go and some of them pop, but I just keep releasing them. And I think that's worked for me, you know, in the space of curating and conversations with artists.
If you were an animal, what would it be?
Ha. Huh. This week it feels like peacock. It's been called that before. I used to think chimpanzee. I'd probably like to be an intelligent one, so I'd probably go with monkey or dolphin. I think dolphins have a very free-ranging possibility, and they can enjoy sex, you know. They can talk to one another. I'd like to be an animal that could do that. So even though I think a peacock is beautiful, I think the cognitive situation would be too limiting. So I'd prefer a higher order mammal.
I think peacocks have sex too, but maybe dolphin sex is better. Which game do you like to play?
I think art is a game. It's a game you play with people you might not have ever met, and they might only not even be alive anymore. You know, you're in conversation with all these people who kind of, they make a move and you think, oh, I'd love to send that back, send that back out into the game.
What's your favorite color?
Do you like blood red?
Do you have a recurring dream?
Yeah, I'm usually being pursued through a cocktail party. I'm usually at a wonderful vernissage in Venice or something, and I kind of have to go because someone's after me, and I'm kind of usually running through Palazzo.
Do you listen to music while you work?
I can't write while listening to music because I listen to punk music. I listen to loud, fast rock and roll a lot of the time. It's a hangover from my teenage years. I haven't really lived it down, but I'm not really allowed to play it on stereos. No one wants to hear it around me. My wife doesn't want to hear it. No, I don't think my colleagues do. Those are my private music moments. And then at home with my kids, I have to play them, you know, James Brown or something. They love James Brown and Kraftwerk and so on.
Which topic would you like to see in an entire issue of Weltkunst?
Berlin. I still think it's the capital of art in the world. You know, it was Paris, it was New York. I believe it's Berlin. Sure, New York is good. Sure, like LA is kind of cool, like London. But I still think this is a place where when I go out, I always meet a new artist. Good ones, you know, by accident. From visual art, from music, from dance, this city, from literature. I mean, the city is just so deep with artists that you can just swim constantly in this, and it's absolutely rare.
Can you share a wisdom?
Yeah, well, I mean, art is play. You know, as I said earlier, it's a game, it's play. If you're trying to do the right thing, you're probably not going to do it well. The thing you put out there now is always incomplete, it's imperfect. And if you try to control too much, you'll probably be waiting too long, or it'll come out too cold. You have to move quickly in your passion and not be overly perfect about it, because it's the imperfection that makes it human.
Thank you so much, Nadim. This was a pleasure.
And thank you.
I can only encourage everyone to see the show. Our podcast is supported by Volkswagen Group Culture, just like the exhibition, which runs through May 26th, and the digital program of KW Institute for Contemporary Art. You can find more information about Volkswagen Group's support online and by following them on Instagram. If you enjoyed this podcast, don't forget to rate or comment it.